Have to if you don't want to. I like to draw. This comes from Crystal, already leaning off the bed to reach beneath it, where several tattered notebooks sit. She pulls one from the pile and opens it up. See? On the page is a sketch of a superhero, a woman with fiery eyes and the bulging muscles of a weightlifter. Her uniform is dark blue and skin tight, with a green skull emblazoned across the chest. The skull's eyes glow red. You did this? I say, sincerely impressed. It's really good. And it is. The hero's face is perfect. She's been given a square jaw, a sharp nose, eyes that blaze with defiance. Her hair flows off her head in dark tendrils. With a few strokes of her pencil, Crystal has conveyed this woman's strength, courage, and determination. Her name is Skullcrusher. She can kill a man with her bare hands. I wouldn't want it any other way, I say. Since you're already an artist, I'll let you draw while the others paint. Crystal accepts the deal with a smile. Cool. She and Sasha continue to stare as I unpack, waiting for me to say more. Feeling extremely awkward, I ask, So why did you want to come to camp?
My guidance counselor at school suggested it, Sasha says. She said it would be a good learning experience for me, seeing how I'm inquisitive.
Oh, I say, about what?
Everything.
I see. My dad wanted me to come, Crystal says. It was either this or get a job flipping burgers somewhere. I think you made the right choice.
I didn't want to come, Miranda says. My grandmother forced me to. She said I'd only get in trouble if I stayed home this summer.
I look up at her. And would you?
Miranda shrugs. Probably.
Listen, I say. Whether you want to be here or not, I need to be clear about something. I'm not here to be your den mother. Or babysitter.
I flick my gaze up at Miranda.
Or warden. I don't want to cramp your style. All of them groan.
What, don't kids say that anymore?
No, Crystal says emphatically.
Definitely not, Sasha adds.
Well, whatever the current equivalent of that is, it's not why I'm here. I'm here to help you learn, if you want. Or, if you'd like, we can just talk. Basically, think of me as your big sister for the summer. I just want you to enjoy yourselves.
I have a question, Sasha says. Are there bears here?
I guess so, I reply, but they're more afraid of us than we are of them.
I did some research before I left home and read that that's not true.
It's probably not, I say, but it's nice to imagine, don't you think?
What about snakes?
What about them?
How many do you think are in the woods? And how many of those are venomous?
I look at Sasha, intimidated by her curiosity. What a delightfully strange girl, with her thick-framed glasses perched on her tiny nose, her eyes wide behind their immaculate lenses. I honestly don't know, I say, but I don't think we need to worry too much about snakes.
Sasha pushes her glasses higher up the bridge of her nose. So we should be more worried about sinkholes? I read that hundreds of thousands of years ago, this whole area was covered by glaciers that left ice deep inside the earth. And that ice eventually melted and ate away at the sandstone, forming deep caves. And sometimes those caves collapse, leaving giant craters. And if you're standing above one when it collapses, you'll fall so deep into the earth that no one will ever find you.
She finally stops, slightly out of breath.
I think we'll be okay, I say. Honestly, the only thing you need to worry about is poison ivy. And getting lost in the woods, Sasha says. According to Wikipedia, it's very common. People disappear all the time.
I nod. Finally, a fact I can confirm. And one that I can't forget.
7.
When it's time for dinner, I stay behind, using the excuse that I have to unpack and change into my shorts and camp polo. The truth is that I want to be alone with Dogwood, just for a moment. I stand in the middle of the cabin, rotating slowly, taking it all in.
It feels different from 15 years ago. Smaller and tighter. Like the cramped sleeping car where Mark and I once spent a red-eye train ride from Paris to Nice. But the cabin's differences are outweighed by its similarities. It has the same smell, pine and musty earth and the faintest trace of wood smoke. The third floorboard from the door still creaks. The trim around the only window still bears its faded blue paint job. A touch of whimsy I noticed even during my first stay here. Memories of the girls' voices returned to me, like an echo of an echo. Random snippets I had completely forgotten until now. Allison mock singing I Feel Pretty while flouncing around in her too big polo shirt. Natalie sitting on the edge of the bottom bunk, her legs spackled with calamine lotion. These mosquitoes are, like, obsessed with me, she said. There's something about my blood that attracts them. I don't think that's how it works, I said. Then why are they biting me and not the rest of you? It's your sweat, Vivian announced. Bugs love it, so slather on that teen spirit, girls. My phone squawks deep inside my pocket, snapping me out of my self-indulgent, admittedly morbid reverie. I dig out the phone and see that Mark's attempting to FaceTime. With only one bar of signal, I have doubts it's going to work. Hey, Veronica Mars, he says once I answer. How's the sleuthing going? I'm just starting. I sit on the edge of my bed, holding out my arm so my entire face fits into the frame. I can't talk very long. The signal here is terrible. Mark gives me his dramatic, pouting face in return. He's in the kitchen of his bistro, the glossy, stainless steel door of the walk-in freezer behind him. How's Camp Crystal Lake? Devoid of masked killers, I say. That's a plus, I suppose. But I'm rooming with three teenage girls. Definitely not in your wheelhouse, Mark says. What are they like? I would describe them as sassy, but that term is probably out of date. Sassy never goes out of style. It's like blue jeans or vodka. Is that a bunk bed? It is indeed, I say. It's about as comfortable as it looks. Mark's expression changes from pouting to horrified. Oh, dear. I apologize for convincing you to go back there. You didn't convince me, I say. You just nudged me a little closer. I wouldn't have nudged if I'd known bunk beds would be involved. His image sputters a moment. When he moves his head, an afterimage follows in a stream of pixels. You're breaking up, I say, when in reality it's me. The signal has dropped from one bar to none. On the screen, Mark's face is frozen, nothing but an abstract blur. Yet I can still hear him. His voice cuts in and out, letting me catch only every other word. You out board, okay? The phone gives up the ghost and the call dies. My screen goes blank. Replacing Mark's face is my own reflection. I stare at it, shocked at how tired I look. Worse than tired. Haggard. No wonder Miranda made that crack about my age. I look positively ancient compared with them. It makes me wonder what the other girls of Dogwood would look like today. Allison would probably still be cute and petite like her mother, who I saw a few years ago in a revival of Sweeney Todd. I spent the whole show wondering how much she thought of her daughter. If there's a picture of Allison in her dressing room, if seeing it made her sad. I suspect Natalie would have remained physically formidable, thanks to sports and college. And Vivian? I'm certain she'd be the same. Slim, stylish, a beauty that bordered on haughtiness. I imagine her taking one look at present-day me and saying, "We need to talk about your hair and your wardrobe." I shove the phone back in my pocket and open my suitcase. Quickly, I change into a pair of shorts and one of the official camp polos that arrived in the mail 2 weeks ago. The rest go into my assigned trunk by the door. It's the same trunk from my previous stay here. I can tell from the grayish stain that mars the satin lining. I close the trunk and run my hands across the lid, feeling the bumps and grooves of all the names that have been carved into the hickory. Another memory prods my thoughts. Me, on my first morning at camp, kneeling before this very trunk with a dull pocket knife in my hand. "Carve your name," Allison urged. "Every girl does it," Natalie added. "It's tradition." I followed that tradition and carved my name. Two letters in all caps, white against the dark wood. E.M. Vivian stood behind me as I did it, her voice soft and encouraging in my ear. "Make your mark. Let future generations know you were here, that you existed." I looked to the other side of the cabin at the two trunks resting by the door, Natalie's and Allison's. Their names have faded with time, barely distinguishable from all the others carved around them. I then moved to the trunk next to mine, Vivian's. She had carved her name in the center of the lid, larger than all the others. Viv. I crack open her trunk, even though I know it's Miranda's now, and that inside aren't Vivian's clothes and crafts and bottle of obsession she swore covered the scent of bug spray. In their place are Miranda's clothes, an assortment of too tight shorts and lacy bras and panties, utterly inappropriate for camp. In a corner sits a surprisingly high stack of paperbacks. Gone Girl, Rosemary's Baby, a few Agatha Christie mysteries. But the lining inside the lid is the same. Burgundy satin, just like mine. The only difference, other than the gray stain, is a 6-inch tear in the fabric. It sits on the left side of the lid, running vertically, the edges feathery. Vivian's hiding place, used to store the pendant necklace she took off only when she slept. A heart-shaped locket hung from it, gold with a small emerald inlaid in its center. I know of the hiding place only because I saw Vivian use it on the first full day of camp. I was at my own trunk, searching for my toothbrush, when she knelt in front of hers. She unclasped the necklace and held it for a moment in her cupped hands. "That's pretty," I said. "An heirloom?" "It belonged to my sister."
"Belonged?"
"She died."
"Sorry."
Apprehension fluttered in my chest. I'd never met someone with a dead sibling before, and didn't know how to act.
"I didn't mean to bring it up."
"You didn't," Vivian said. "I did. And it's healthy to talk about it. That's what my therapist says." I felt another flutter. A dead sister and therapy? At that moment, Vivian was the most exotic creature I had ever met.
"How'd she die?"
"She drowned."
"Oh,"
I said, too surprised to say more. Vivian didn't say anything else either. She simply poked her fingers through the tear in the lining and let the necklace slither out of view behind it. Now I stare at the slash in the fabric, fingering my own piece of jewelry. Unlike Vivian's necklace, I never remove the charm bracelet. Not to sleep, not to shower, not even when painting. The wear and tear shows. Each tiny bird has scratches in the pewter that stand out like scars. Dots of dried paint mar their beaks. I pry my right hand away from the bracelet and plunge it through the tear in the lining. Fabric tickles my wrist as I stretch my fingers and feel around the inside of the lid. I'm not expecting to find anything, certainly not the necklace, which Vivian had been wearing when she left the cabin for the very last time. I do it because once I check, I'll know there's no trace of Vivian left there. Only there is. Something is inside the lid, sitting at the bottom, wedged between wood and fabric. A piece of paper folded in half. I run a finger along the crease, feeling its length. Then I pinch the edge between my thumb and forefinger and slide it from the lining. Age has given the paper a yellowish tint, a sickly shade that reminds me of dried egg yolk. The page crackles when I unfold it, revealing an even older-looking photograph nestled in its crease. I study the photo first. It's surprisingly old. Something more likely to be found in a museum than in a camp cabin. Sepia-toned and worn along the edges, it depicts a young woman in a plain dress. She sits before a bare wall, turned at an angle that shows off long, dark hair cascading down her back and out of frame. Clutched in the woman's hands is a large silver hairbrush, which she holds to her chest like a prized possession. I find the gesture oddly endearing, although one could also assume it's vanity that makes her grip the brush so tightly. That she spends her days running it through that absurdly long hair, breaking up the tangles, smoothing the strands. But the woman's expression makes me assume that's not the case. Although she looks to be in repose, her face is anything but peaceful. Her lips are pressed together, forming a flat line. Her face is pinched. Her eyes, wild and dark, convey sadness, loneliness, and something else, an emotion I know well. Distress. I stare into those eyes, finding them disturbingly familiar. I've seen that same expression in my own eyes. Not long after I left Camp Nightingale for what I had thought was the last time. I flip over the photo and see a name scrawled on its back in faded ink. Eleanor Auburn. Several questions settle uneasily onto my shoulders. Who is this woman? When was this picture taken? And above all else, where did Vivian get it, and why was it hidden in her trunk? The contents of the unfolded page don't provide any answers. Instead, I see a drawing crudely scratched onto a ruled piece of paper torn from some sort of notebook. The focal point of the drawing is a blob that resembles a paisley, strange and formless. Surrounding it are hundreds of dark slashes, each dashed off in strokes so quick and forceful my painting hand aches just from looking at them. Beneath the paisley, tucked among the slashes, are several shapes, messy ones, not quite circles, not quite squares. Off to their left is another circle square, bigger than the others. I realize what it is and gasp. For reasons I can't begin to understand, Vivian drew Camp Nightingale. The paisley is Lake Midnight, dominating the landscape, demanding attention. The slashes are an abstract version of the woods surrounding it. The series of shapes are the cabins. I count 20 of them, just like in real life. The big splotch, of course, is the lodge, commanding the southern shore of the lake. Vivian had drawn another cabin-sized shape on the other side of the lake, almost directly across from camp. It sits next to the water all alone. Only there aren't any structures on the other side of the lake. At least none that I'm aware of. Just like the photo, the sketch defies explanation. I try to think of a logical reason why Vivian drew it, but come up empty. She had gone here 3 summers in a row. Surely there was no need for her to draw a map of the camp to find her way around. Because that is indeed what it looks like. A map, not just of camp, but of the entire lake. It reminds me of the satellite view I studied on the ride here. All of Lake Midnight in one handy image. I bring the page closer to my face, zeroing in not on the camp, but on the area on the other side of the lake. A short distance behind the mystery structure is something barely distinguishable from the slashes that surround it. An X. Small but noticeable, it sits near a cluster of ragged triangles that resemble tiny mountains drawn by a kindergartner. Vivian had used extra force when drawing it. The lines push into the paper, creating 2 crisscrossed indentations. That means it was important to her, that something of interest was located there. I fold the photograph inside the map and secure them both inside my own hickory trunk. It strikes me that if Vivian had taken such great care to hide them, then I should do the same thing. It was, after all, her secret. And I've become very good at keeping them. 15 years ago.
There's one thing you need to know about this place, Vivian said.
Never arrive to anything on time. Either be there first or get there last.
Even meals? I asked.
Especially meals. You won't believe how crazy some of these bitches get around food.
It was my first morning at camp, and Vivian and I had just left the latrine on the way to the mess hall. Although the mealtime bell rang 15 minutes earlier, Vivian showed no sign of hurry. Her pace bordered on lackadaisical as she looped her arm through mine, forcing me to slow as well. When we eventually did reach the mess hall, I noticed a girl with frizzy hair standing outside the arts and crafts building with a camera around her neck. She noticed us, too, because something flickered in her eyes. Recognition, maybe, or worry. It lasted only a second before she raised her camera and aimed it our way, the blue-black lens following us as we entered the mess hall.
"Who is that taking our picture?" I asked.
"Becca," Vivian said. "Don't mind her. She's a nobody."
Taking my hand, she pulled me toward the front of the room, where a handful of kitchen workers in hairnets stood before steaming trays of food. Because we were among the last to arrive, there was no wait. Vivian was right, not that I ever doubted her. The only person later than us was a smiling, red-headed counselor with the name Casey stitched onto her camp polo. She was short, practically my height, and had a pear-shaped frame made more pronounced by the large pockets of her cargo shorts.
"Well, if it isn't Vivian Hawthorne," she said. "You told me last summer that you were done with this place. Couldn't stay away."
"And miss out on a chance to torment you for another summer?"
Vivian said as she grabbed two bananas, placing one of them on my tray.
"No way." And here I thought I was going to have it easy this year.
The counselor gave me an appraising look. She seemed surprised, not to mention a little confused, to see me by Vivian's side.
"You're new, right?"
Vivian ordered two bowls of clumpy oatmeal, again giving one to me.
"Emma, this is Casey, former camper, current counselor, forever bane of my existence. Casey, meet Emma."
I lifted my tray up and down in a weak approximation of a wave.
"Nice to meet you."
"She's my protege," Vivian said. "That's a scary thought."
Casey turned to me again and put a hand on my shoulder.
"Come see me if she starts to corrupt you too much. I'm in Birch."
She passed us on her way to a decanter of coffee and the platter of donuts next to it. Before leaving the food line, I also ordered what I really wanted for breakfast, toast and a plate of bacon. Vivian eyed the extra side dishes but said nothing. We then made our way through the clanging, slurping girls huddled at tables in configurations familiar from my school's cafeteria. Younger girls on one side, older ones on the other. And at that moment, I wasn't adhering to my socially acceptable pack. A few girls my age took notice and watched with envy as Vivian led me to the side of the mess hall populated by older girls. She waved to some and ignored others before sitting me down with Allison and Natalie. I had been awake when the two of them left the cabin to head to the latrine. Although they invited me to join them, I stayed behind, waiting for Vivian to rise. She was the only one I wanted showing me the ropes. While Allison and Natalie seemed nice, they reminded me too much of girls I knew at school. Slightly older versions of Heather and Marissa. Vivian was different. I'd never met anyone so unfiltered. To a shy girl like me, her attention was as warm and welcome as the sun.
"Morning, bitches," she said to the others. "Sleep well?"
"The usual," Allison said as she picked at a bowl of fruit salad.
"You, Emma?"
"Great," I said.
It was a lie. The cabin was too stuffy, too quiet. I missed air conditioning and the sounds of Manhattan, all those irritated car horns and wailing sirens in the distance. At Camp Nightingale, there was nothing but bug noise and the lake lapping against the shore. I assumed I'd get used to it.
"Thank God you don't snore, Em," Vivian said. "We had a snorer last year. Sounded like a dying cow."
"It wasn't that bad," said Natalie.
On her tray sat two servings of bacon and the syrupy remains of flapjacks. She bit into a bacon slice, chewing and talking at the same time.
You're just being mean because you don't like her anymore.
Already, I had noticed the weird dynamic between the three of them. Vivian was the ringleader, obviously. Natalie, athletic and a little bit gruff, was the resistance. Pretty, subdued Allison was the peacekeeper, a role she assumed that very morning.
Tell us about yourself, Emma, she said. You don't go to our school, right?
Of course she doesn't, Vivian replied. We'd know if she did. Half our school goes here.
I go to Douglas Academy, I said.
Allison stabbed a chunk of melon, lifted it to her lips, put it back down.
Do you like it there?
It's nice, I guess, for an all-girls school.
Ours is too, Vivian said, and I'd honestly kill to spend a summer away from some of these sluts.
Why? Natalie asked. You pretend half of them don't exist when we're here.
Just like I'm pretending right now that you're not stuffing your face with bacon, Vivian shot back. Keep eating like that and next year it'll be fat camp for you.
Natalie sighed and dropped the half-eaten bacon onto her plate.
You want any, Allison?
Allison shook her head and pushed away her barely touched bowl of fruit.
I'm stuffed.
I was just joking, Vivian said, looking genuinely remorseful.
I'm sorry, Nat, really. You look fine.
She smiled then, the word lingering like the insult it really was. I spent the rest of the meal eyeing Vivian's plate, taking a bite of oatmeal only when she did, trying to make the portions match up exactly. I didn't touch the banana until she did. When she left half of it on her tray, I did the same. The bacon and toast remained untouched. I told myself it would be worth it. Vivian, Natalie, and Allison left the mess hall before me, preparing for an advanced archery lesson. Senior campers only. I was scheduled to take part in an activity with girls my own age. I assumed I'd find them boring. That's what one night in Dogwood had already done to me. On my way there, I passed the girl with the camera. She veered into my path, halting me.
What are you doing?
Warning you, she said, about Vivian.
What do you mean?
Don't be fooled. She'll turn on you eventually. I took a step toward her, trying to match the same toughness I had summoned the previous night.
How so?
Although the girl with the camera smiled, there was no humor there. It was a bitter grin, on the cusp of curdling into a sneer.
You'll find out, she said.
8. Arriving at the mess hall for dinner, I find Franny standing at the head of the room, already halfway through her welcome speech. She appears more robust than before. It's clear she's in her element, dressed for the great outdoors before a packed room of girls while extolling the virtues of camp life. She sweeps her gaze across the room as she speaks, making momentary eye contact with each and every girl, silently welcoming them. When she spots me by the door, her eyes crinkle ever so slightly, an almost wink. The speech sounds just like the one I heard 15 years ago. For all I know, it could be exactly the same, summoned from Franny's memory after all these years. She's already recited the part about how the lake was formed by her grandfather on that long-ago New Year's Eve, and is now delving into the history of the camp itself.
For years, this land served as a private retreat for my family. As a child, I spent every summer, and quite a few winters, springs, and falls, exploring the thousands of acres my family was fortunate enough to own. When my parents passed away, it was left to me. So in 1973, I decided to turn the Harris family retreat into a camp for girls. Camp Nightingale opened a year later, where it welcomed generations of young women.
She pauses, just long enough for her to take a breath. But contained in that brief silence are years of omitted history. About my friends, the camp's shame, its subsequent closure,
Today, the camp welcomes all of you, Franny says. Camp Nightingale isn't about cliques or popularity contests or feeling superior. It's about you, all of you, giving each and every one of you an experience to cherish long after the summer is over. So if you need anything at all, don't hesitate to ask Lottie, my sons, or Mindy, the newest member of our family. She gestures to her left, where Chet stands against the wall, pretending not to notice the adoring gazes of half the girls in the room. Next to him, Mindy smiles and gives a beauty pageant wave. I scan the room looking for Theo. There's no sign of him, which is both a disappointment and a relief. Franny clasps her hands together and bows her head, signaling that the speech is over. But I know it's not. There's still one part left, completely scripted, but performed with the polish of a career politician. Oh, one last thing, Franny says, pretending to think of it just now. I don't want to hear a single one of you call me Mrs. Harris White. Call me Franny. I insist upon it. Here in the great outdoors, we're all equals. From her spot along the wall, Mindy starts clapping. Chet does too, albeit with more reluctance. Soon, the whole room is applauding as Franny, their benefactor, takes another quick bow. Then she's off, skirting out of the mess hall via a side door opened by Lottie. I make my way to the food stations, where a small crew of white-uniformed cooks dish out greasy hamburgers, fries, and coleslaw so runny that milky liquid sloshes around the bottom of the plate. Rather than join Sasha, Crystal, and Miranda, who are surrounded on all sides by other campers, I head to a table near the door where 8 women are seated. 5 of them are young, definitely college age, the camp counselors. The other 3 range in age from mid-30s to pushing 60. My fellow instructors, minus Rebecca Schoenfeld. I recognize only one, Casey Anderson. Little about her has changed between then and now. She's still got that pear-shaped frame and red hair that grazes her shoulder when she tilts her head in sympathy upon seeing me again. She even gives me a hug and says, "It's good to see you back here, Emma." The other instructors nod hello. The counselors merely stare. All of them, I realize, know not only who I am, but also what happened while I was here. Casey introduces me to the other instructors. Teaching creative writing is Roberta Wright Smith, who attended Camp Nightingale for 3 summers, beginning with its inaugural season. She's plump and jolly and peers at me through a pair of glasses perched on her nose. Paige McAdams, who went here in the late 80s, is gray-haired and willowy, with bony fingers that clasp my hand too hard when she shakes it. She's here to teach pottery, which explains her grip. Casey informs me she's been assigned to that catch-all camp staple of arts and crafts. She's an 8th-grade English teacher during the school year, available to help out here because her 2 kids are away at their own camp, and it's her first summer alone since she divorced her husband. Divorce, it turns out, is a dominant theme among the other instructors. Casey wanted to escape 6 weeks alone in an empty house. Paige needed a place to go until her soon-to-be ex-husband moves out of their Brooklyn apartment. And Roberta, a creative writing professor at Syracuse, wanted to go somewhere quiet after recently parting ways with her poet girlfriend. I'm the only one, it seems, who doesn't have a former spouse or partner to blame for being here. I'm not sure if that's liberating or merely pathetic. I suppose I have more in common with the counselors, those college juniors who've yet to be touched by life's disappointments. They're all pretty and bland and basically interchangeable. Hair pulled into ponytails, pink lip gloss, their exfoliated faces glisten. They are, I realize, exactly the kind of girls who would have attended Camp Nightingale had it been open during their adolescence. "Who else is psyched about the summer?" one of them says. I think her name is Kim, or maybe it's Danica.
Each of their names left my memory 5 seconds after I was introduced to them.
I definitely am.
But don't you think it's weird? Casey says. I mean, I'm happy to help out for the summer, but I don't understand Franny's decision to open the camp again after all these years.
I don't think it's necessarily weird, I say. Surprising, maybe.
I vote for weird, Paige says. I mean, why now?
Why not now?
This comes from Mindy, who's swooped up to the table without notice. I find her standing behind me, arms crossed. Although it's unclear how much she's heard, it was enough to make the edges of her plastered-on smile twitch.
Does Franny need a reason for doing a good deed? She says, directing the comment to Roberta, Paige, Casey, and me. I didn't know it was wrong to try to give a new generation of girls the same experiences the four of you had.
If this is an attempt to sound like Franny, she's failing miserably. Franny's speeches might be scripted, but the emotion behind them is real. You believe every word she says. Mindy's tone is different. It comes off so sweetly sanctimonious that I can't help but say, I wouldn't wish my experience here on anyone.
Mindy gives a sad shake of her head. Clearly, I've let her down. Holding her hand to her heart, she says,
I expected more from you, Emma. Franny showed a great deal of courage inviting you back here.
And Emma showed courage by agreeing to come, Casey says, leaping to my defense.
She did, Mindy replies, which is why I thought she'd show a little bit more Camp Nightingale spirit.
I roll my eyes so hard the sockets hurt.
Really?
Fine.
Mindy plops into an empty chair and lets out a sigh that reminds me of air hissing from a punctured tire.
I've been told by Lottie that we need to make a cabin check schedule for the summer.
Ah, cabin check. The nightly examination of all the cabins by counselors to make sure everyone is present, accounted for, and staying out of trouble.
Naturally, it had been the highlight of Vivian's day.
Each night we need 2 people to check on the cabins that don't have counselors or instructors staying in them, Mindy says.
Who wants to volunteer first? And where's Rebecca?
Sleeping, I think, Casey says. I saw her earlier and she said she needed a nap or the jet lag was going to kill her. She was on assignment in London and came straight here from the airport.
I guess we'll have to pencil her in later, Mindy says. Who wants to do it tonight?
As the others wrangle over the schedule, I see the mess hall's double doors open and watch as Rebecca Schoenfeld steps inside. Unlike Casey, she's changed quite a bit. Gone are the braces and the adolescent pudge. She's become harder, compact, with a worldly style. Her hair, once a frizzy mass kept in place with a scrunchie, is now sleek and short. She's accented her shorts and polo ensemble with a brightly colored scarf. Beneath it hangs her camera, which sways as she walks. Her movements are another change. Instead of the shuffling teenager I remember, she walks with swift precision, a woman on a mission. She crosses the mess hall to the food station and grabs an apple. She takes a bite on her way out, stopping only when she spots me on the other side of the room. The look she gives me is unreadable. I can't tell if she's surprised, happy, or confused by my presence. After another sharp bite of apple, she turns and exits the mess hall.
I need to go, I say.
Mindy emits another deflated tire sigh.
What about cabin check?
Sign me up for whenever.
I leave the table, abandoning my tray, the food barely touched. Outside the mess hall, I search in every direction for signs of Becca, but she's nowhere to be found. The areas in front of both the mess hall and the arts and crafts building next door are empty. In the distance, I see Franny slowly making her way to the lodge with Lottie by her side. Beyond the lodge, on the patch of grass that leads down to the lake, I spot the maintenance man who was fixing the roof when I arrived. He pushes a wheelbarrow toward a rickety tool shed situated on the edge of the lawn. Lots of activity, none of it from Becca. I start to head back to the cabins when someone says my name.
Emma?
I freeze, knowing exactly who the voice belongs to. Theo Harris White.
He calls to me from the open door of the Arts and Crafts building. Like Franny's speech, nothing about his voice has changed. Hearing it sends more memories shooting into me. They hurt, like a quiver of arrows to the gut. Seeing Theo for the very first time, shyly shaking his hand, trying not to notice how his t-shirt swelled across his chest, confused about why the sight made me feel so warm inside. Theo, waist-deep in the lake, skin sun-kissed and blazing, me cradled in his arms, practically trembling from his touch as he lowers me in the water until I'm floating. Vivian nudging me toward the extra-wide crack in the latrine's exterior wall. Through the gap escaped the sound of a running shower and Theo absently humming a Green Day song. "Go on," Vivian whispered. "Take a look. He'll never know." "Emma," he says again, this time without the questioning inflection. He knows it's me. I turn around slowly, unsure what to expect. Part of me wants him to be ruddy and balding, the march toward middle age leaving him thick around the waist. Another part of me wants him to look exactly the same. The reality is somewhere in between. He's aged, of course, no longer the strapping 19-year-old I remember him being. That youthful glow has dimmed into something darker, more intense. Yet he wears the years well. Too well, to be honest. There's more bulk than before, but it's all muscle. The flecks of gray in his dark hair and 5 o'clock shadow suit him. So does the slight weathering of his face. When he smiles at me, a few faint wrinkles crepe the skin around his mouth and eyes. I hate that it only makes him look more attractive. "Hi." It's not much of a greeting, but it's the best I can manage, especially while I'm being blindsided by another memory, one that eclipses the others. Theo, standing in front of the lodge, looking exhausted and disheveled after a day spent searching the woods. Me rushing at him, crying as I pound his chest and scream, "Where are they? What did you do to them?" Until today, it was the last thing I ever said to him. Now that he's right here in front of me again, I expect him to be angry or bitter about what I'd accused him of doing all those years ago. It makes me want to flee the same way Becca had left the mess hall, only faster. But I stay completely still as Theo steps forward and, shockingly, gives me a hug. I pull away after only a second, afraid touching him for too long will prompt even more memories. Theo takes a step back, looks at me, shakes his head. "I can't believe you're really here. My mother told me you were coming, but I just didn't think it would happen." "Here I am." "And it looks like life is treating you well. You look great." He's being kind. I saw my reflection in the blank screen of my phone. I know how I look.
"So do you," I say.
"I hear you're a painter now. Mom told me she bought one of your works. I haven't had a chance to see it yet. I just got back from Africa 2 days ago."
"Franny mentioned that. You're a doctor?"
Theo gives a little shrug, scratches his beard.
"Yeah, a pediatrician. I've spent the past year working with Doctors Without Borders. But for the next 6 weeks, I've been demoted to camp nurse."
"I guess that makes me the camp painter," I say.
"Speaking of which, I was just working on your studio for the summer."
Theo jerks his head toward the Arts and Crafts building.
"Care to take a peek?"
"Now?" I say, surprised by his casual willingness to remain alone with me.
"No time like the present," Theo says, head cocked, his face poised somewhere between curiosity and confusion.
It is, I realize, the same look Franny gave me earlier on the lodge's back deck.
"Sure," I say. "Lead the way."
I follow him inside, finding myself in the middle of an airy, open room.
The walls have been painted a cheerful sky blue. The carpet and baseboard are as green as grass. The three support columns that rise from the floor to the ceiling in equal intervals have been painted to resemble trees. The areas where they meet on the ceiling contain fake branches that drip with paper leaves. It's like stepping into a picture book, happy and bright. To our left is a little photo studio for Becca, complete with brand new digital cameras, charging stations, and a handful of sleek computers used for processing pictures. The center of the room is an elaborate craft station, full of circular tables, cubbyholes, and cabinets, filled with string, beads, leather bands the color of saddles. I spot several dozen laptops for Roberta's writing classes and a pair of pottery wheels for Paige. I'm impressed, I say. Franny did a great job fixing this place up. This is all Mindy's handiwork, actually, Theo tells me. She's really thrown herself into reopening the camp. I'm not surprised. She's certainly enthusiastic. I was going to say overwhelming, but that works too. Theo leads me to the far end of the room, where a semicircle of easels has been set up. Along one wall is a shelf holding tubes of oil paints and brushes clustered in mason jars. Clean palettes hang next to windows that let in natural light. I roam the area, fingers trailing over a blank canvas leaning on one of the easels. At the shelf of paints, I see 100 different colors all arranged by hue. Lavender and chartreuse, cherry red and royal blue. I put your supplies over there, Theo says, gesturing to the box I brought with me. I figured you'd want to unpack them yourself. Honestly, there's no need. Everything I could possibly want is already here. Yet I go to the box anyway and start pulling out my personal supplies. The well-worn brushes, the squished tubes of paint, the palette so thoroughly speckled with color that it resembles a Pollock painting. Theo stands on the other side of the box, watching me unpack. Fading light from the window falls across his face, highlighting something that's definitely different from 15 years ago. Something I didn't notice until just now. A scar. Located on his left cheek, it's an inch-long line that slants toward his mouth. It's a single shade lighter than the rest of his face, which is why I had missed it earlier. But now that I know it's there, I can't stop looking at it. I'm about to ask Theo how he got it when he checks his watch and says, I need to go help Chet with the campfire. Will I see you there? Of course, I say. I never turn down an opportunity to have s'mores. Good. That you're coming, I mean. Theo's departure is hesitant, a slow amble to the door. When he reaches it, he turns around and says, Hey, Emma. I look up for my supplies, the suddenly serious tone of his voice worrying me. I suspect he's about to mention the last time we saw each other. He's certainly thinking about it. The tension between us is like a fraying rope pulled taut, ready to snap. Theo opens his mouth, reconsiders what he's about to say, closes it again. When he finally does speak, sincerity tinges his voice. I'm glad you're here. I know it isn't easy, but it means a lot to my mother. It means a lot to me, too. Then he's gone, leaving me alone to wonder what exactly he meant by that. Does it mean a lot to him because it pleases Franny, or does it mean my presence reminds him of happier times before the camp shuddered in disgrace? Ultimately, I decide it's neither of those things. In truth, I think it means he forgives me. Now all I need is to somehow find a way to forgive myself. 9. Apparently, to Mindy, whenever meant tonight, because after the campfire, I find myself on cabin check duty. While not thrilled, I'm at least pleased to have Casey as my co-checker.
Together, we go from cabin to cabin, peeking inside to do a head count and ask if any of the campers need anything. It's strange being on the other side of things, especially with Casey in tow. When I was a camper here, she'd give a single rap on the door before throwing it open, trying to catch us in the act of some imagined misbehavior. We greeted her with wide-eyed innocence, lashes fluttering. Now I'm the one getting those looks. A surreal turn of events that makes me feel partly jealous of their mischievous youth, partly annoyed by it. In two of the cabins, I find girls balled up in their bunks, crying from homesickness. While Vivian was wrong about all newbies crying their first night, a small few truly do. I spend a few minutes with each one, telling them that while camp may seem scary now, they'll soon grow to love it and will never want to go back home. I hope it's the truth. I never got the chance to find out. After the cabins have all been checked, Casey and I walk to the patch of grass behind the latrine. It's dark back here, made even more oppressive by the forest that begins a yard or so away. Shadows crowd the trees, broken only by fireflies dancing among the leaves. The utility light affixed to the latrine's corner swarms with bugs. Casey pulls a cigarette from a battered pack hidden in her cargo shorts and lights up. I can't believe I'm sneaking cigarettes. I feel like I'm 14 again. Better this than face the wrath of Mindy. Want to know a secret? Casey says. Her real name is Melinda. She goes by Mindy to be more like Franny. I get the feeling Franny doesn't like her very much. I can see why. She's the kind of girl I went out of my way to avoid in high school. Casey blows out a stream of smoke and watches it languidly float in the night air. Honestly, though, it's probably for the best that she's here. Without her, it would be open season on poor Chet. These girls would eat him alive. But they're all so young. I'm a teacher, Casey says. Trust me, girls that age are just as full of raging hormones as boys. Remember how you were back then? I saw the way you fawned over Theo. Not that I blamed you. He was a fine-looking young man. Have you seen him now? Casey gives a slow, knowing nod. Why is it that men only look better with age? It's completely unfair. But he's still just as friendly, I say. I didn't expect that. Because of what you said last time you were here? And because of what people are saying now. I saw some of the responses to your Facebook post. They were pretty brutal. Ignore them. Casey gives her hand a casual flip, as if brushing away the smoke still spouting from her cigarette. Most of those women are just adult versions of the bitchy teenagers they were when they went here. A few of them mentioned that this place gave them the creeps, I say. Something about a legend. It's just a silly campfire tale. So you've heard it. I've told it, Casey says. That doesn't mean I think the story is true. I can't believe you never heard it. I guess I wasn't here long enough. Casey looks at me, the cigarette held between her lips, its trail of smoke making her squint. The story is that there was a village here, she says, before the lake was made. Some will say it was full of deaf people. I heard it was a leper colony. A leper colony? Was an ancient Indian burial ground too much of a cliché? I didn't make up the story, Casey snaps. Now, do you want to hear it or not? I do, no matter how ridiculous it seems, so I nod for her to continue. Deaf village and leper colony aside, the rest of the story is the same, Casey says. It's that Franny's grandfather saw this valley and decided on the spot it was where he was going to create his lake. But there was one problem. The village sat right in the middle of it. When Buchanan Harris approached the villagers and offered to buy their land, they refused. They were a small, tight-knit community, ostracized by the rest of the world. This was their home, and they weren't going to sell it. This made Mr. Harris angry. He was a man accustomed to getting what he wanted. So when he increased his offer and the villagers again refused, he bought all the land surrounding them instead. Then he built his dam and flooded the valley at the stroke of midnight,
knowing the water would wash away the village and that everyone who lived there would drown. She lowers her voice, speaking slowly, full storyteller mode. The village is still there, deep below Lake Midnight, and the people who drowned now haunt the woods and the lake. They appear at midnight, rising from the water and roaming the forest. Anyone unlucky enough to encounter them gets dragged into the lake and pulled to the bottom, where they quickly drown. Then they become one of the ghosts, cursed to search the woods for all eternity looking for more victims. I gave her an incredulous look. And that's what people think happened to Vivian, Natalie, and Allison? No one truly believes that, Casey says, but bad things have happened here with no explanation. Franny's husband, for example, he was a champion swimmer, almost made it to the Olympics, yet he drowned. I heard that Franny's grandmother, the first wife of Buchanan Harris, also drowned here. So when Vivian and the others disappeared, some people said it was the ghosts of Lake Midnight, or else the survivors. Survivors? It's been said that a handful of villagers escaped the rising waters and fled into the hills. There they stayed, living off the land, rebuilding the village in a remote section of the woods where no one could find them. The whole time they held a grudge against the Harris family, passing it on to their descendants. Those descendants are still there, hidden somewhere in the woods. And on nights when the moon is full, they sneak down to the land that used to belong to them and exact their revenge. Vivian, Natalie, and Allison were just three of their victims. It turns out that Casey's an expert tailspinner, for as she finishes, I feel a chill in the air. A light frisson that makes me look to the woods behind her, half expecting to see either a ghostly figure or mutant forest dweller emerging from the tree line. What do you really think happened to them? I say. I think they got lost in the woods. Vivian was always wandering off. Casey drops her cigarette and grinds it out with the toe of her sneaker. Which is why I've always felt partly responsible for what happened. I was a camp counselor. It was my job to make sure all of you were safe, and I regret not paying more attention to you and what was going on in that cabin. I stare at her, surprised. Were there things going on I didn't know about? I don't know, Casey says as she fumbles in her pocket for another cigarette. Maybe. Like what? You were friends with Vivian. Surely you noticed something. I wouldn't say the two of us were friends. I was a senior camper her first summer, and then came back to work as a counselor the 2 years after that. She was always a troublemaker, but charming enough to get away with it. Oh, I know that all too well. Vivian excelled at charm. That and lying were her two greatest skills. But something about her seemed off that last summer, Casey continues. Not majorly different, nothing that someone who only knew her casually would notice. But she wasn't the same. She seemed distracted. I think of the strange map Vivian had drawn and the even stranger photo of the woman with long hair. By what? Casey shrugs and looks away again as she irritably puffs out more smoke. I don't know, Emma. Like I said, we weren't that close. But you noticed things. Little things, Casey says. I noticed her walking alone around camp a few times, which never happened the previous summers. Vivian was always surrounded by people, and maybe she just wanted to be left alone. Or maybe... Her voice trails off as she takes one last draw of her cigarette. Maybe what? She was up to no good, Casey says. On the second day of camp, I caught her trying to sneak into the lodge. She was hanging around the steps on the back deck, ready to run inside. She said she was looking for Franny, but I didn't buy it. Why would she want to break into the lodge? Casey shrugs again. The gesture contains a note of annoyance, almost as if she wishes she'd never brought up the topic of Vivian. Your guess is as good as mine, she says. My final stop on cabin check is Dogwood, where I find all three girls on their beds, phones in hand, faces awash in the ice-blue light of their screens. Sasha is already under the covers, her glasses perched on the tip of her nose as she plays Candy Crush or some similarly frustrating time waste of a game.